So, we're looking at the book of Judges. Do you remember Justin covered Joshua last week? Joshua and Judges are kind of paired together, and Ruth is kind of involved in that too. All three cover the same general time period, but especially Joshua and Judges, they're kind of two different moods, really. Joshua is a pretty positive book. There's some dark parts to it, but overall, this is what the whole Torah has been looking forward to. The entrance into the land of Canaan, the acquiring of the promised land. This is where rest should be found. And Judges is the reality coming in to shatter those expectations that there won't be rest here, that entrance into the promised land does not mean that all of the problems will be solved, that there's going to be some kind of eschatological reality realized here. The book title, you won't be surprised, in all three languages, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, it just means Judges. Nothing too interesting there. The judges we're talking about, as you might suspect, these are not normal judges the way we would think of judges. These are more militaristic deliverers. They're not the big wigs in the courtroom kind of judges. The author of the book, some suggest it's Samuel, but we really don't know. And we emphasize the importance of the author when the Bible tells us who the author is. And so we do emphasize, we believe it's important that we affirm that Moses authored the Torah, Moses authored the Pentateuch. Why? Because the Bible says so. When all of Paul's epistles say, I, Paul, it's important for us to say, yes, this is Paul. This is not someone else writing in Paul's name. But for books that don't give us the author, it's not going to be super important that we're dogmatic about who the author is. But it is important, I think, to suggest that this is the mind of a single person. And especially when we look at the structure of the book, the structure of the book is really interesting. It brings us to the idea of genre. This is historical narrative, but it's something that surprised me reflecting on this recently. I used to think of historical narrative in the Bible as like you just pull a history book off the shelf, nothing to it. The author just tells you this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. Historical narrative in the Bible is not like that. Historical narrative in the Bible, the very structure of the thing is meant to tell you something. Historical narrative in the Bible is not exhaustive, it is selective. And the reason for that is because the author is trying to tell you a bigger point based on all these historical events. It is historical. These things did happen. So anybody that wants to emphasize the literary aspects of this and wants to downplay the historical elements, we don't want to go there. This is history. This did happen. But the author is selective in what he talks about and the way it's arranged because he wants us to come away with a theological conclusion based on this history. And so with that in mind, that's why I would suggest this is the mind of one person behind the book. It's not a team of editors like liberals would like to say. This is one mind that has organized all this to tell us a message. The date, we don't really know for sure, but we believe it's around the time of Saul when this book was written. So you would expect that. After all this stuff happens, somebody writes it down. Nothing really shocking there. When we come to the outline, I'd like you to turn to Judges chapter 2. Really, Judges chapter 2 gives us a passage that encapsulates the whole book. Let's begin in verse 6. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him in the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that had been done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned and as the Lord had sworn to them. And he swore this to them in Deuteronomy 28 and probably other texts too. But Deuteronomy 28 is the main one that comes to my mind. And they were in terrible distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge. And he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And he said, because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. So the Lord left those nations, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. And there, that's the summary of the whole book. You have a cycle of there's a time of faithfulness, which slips into unfaithfulness, which slips into captivity, which slips into persecution of God's people. They cry out to God. God hears them and has pity on them, raises up a judge who saves them, and they're faithful for a little bit again. And the cycle keeps going. But it's not even as simple as that, because the text even says this. It kind of degrades as we go through the book. The times of faithfulness get shorter. The level of unfaithfulness gets greater. So the book has this kind of cycle that it's talking about, but the cycle isn't equal throughout the book. It is a degradation through the whole book as well. So as far as the outline itself, we have an introduction in chapter 1 verses through chapter 3, verse 6. That gives us the background information of the book. And we read a large portion of that just now. When you get to chapter 3, verse 7, you begin with the first judge, Othniel. Now, Othniel is not some random person, as some of the other judges might appear to be. Othniel is Caleb's nephew, I think. And remember, Caleb and Joshua were the two righteous spies who told the people they could go into the land. Othniel is related to Caleb, and he is the best judge in the book. There's nothing bad said about him. He marries a faithful Israelite woman, which is an important detail for later. But there are seven narratives in this section. Chapter 3, starting verse 7, through chapter 16, the end of chapter 16. There are seven narratives. And immediately, That should be important to you. If we're talking about rest, the book has talked about rest a lot. We have seven sections. That's important. Again, the author's selective. He's wanting us to come away with a theological conclusion. And then the last section, 17 through 21, is a kind of double epilogue. There's two stories here. They're both really bad, really dark. Some of the darkest sections in all of Scripture. So I think it'd be good just to back up and talk more about the outline. You have the seven narratives in the Judges section. You have Othniel, you have Ehud, you have Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Jephthah, and Samson. These are the major narratives. Now, I hesitate to call them all judges because I don't think Abimelech is considered a judge. But he has still got a major narrative in this section. Now, listen to some of these, listen to the summaries of these judges. We've talked about Othniel a little bit. Othniel is the best judge. Nothing bad is said about him. There's nothing conflicted. And he marries a faithful Israelite wife. Ehud is pretty good. And really, there's nothing bad said about him. Some have suggested that the detail that he's left-handed in ancient cultures would have been seen as something not right. If you were left-handed, you were seen as deceptive. But really, nothing bad is said about Ehud. And he is he's a strong deliverer. And if we were to summarize his account, I would summarize it as a comedic account of the taking of the fords of Jordan with the Ephraimites, from the king of Moab. And so, remember, I'll say it again. Ehud is a comedic account of the taking of the fords of Jordan with the Ephraimites, from the king of Moab. All these details are going to be important later. You come to Deborah, and a lot of the thrust of the account with Deborah really does emphasize that she's a woman and she's a judge. I remembered reading that, like, the word for prophetess or the word for judge that's in the feminine, but then the word woman is also there, which I don't know if it's translated, but it's really emphasizing that she's a woman. Yeah, the word prophetess is here. The reason for that is because it's not normal. And it's really emphasizing this is a woman that's in charge. And when you see in the text, Barak is told to lead the army, and he says, I'll go if you go with me, which is not something that we should see as admirable. This is not something we should be congratulating Barak for. This is something we should be saying, come on, you should just have faith that this is the word of the Lord and go do it. But the interesting details at the end. Deborah gives the prophecy, okay, Barak, I'll go with you, you'll win, but the glory of the victory will not go to you, it will go to a woman. And they're fighting Sisera, the general of the enemies that they're fighting at this time. And Jael is a woman, if you remember the story, who brings Sisera into her tent, takes care of him, he goes to sleep, and she drives a tent peg through his temple. And one of the interesting things, if we're thinking about this in the context of the whole Bible, she crushes the head of God's enemies, which should remind you of something. Gideon is very similar to Moses in his call. The angel of the Lord appears to Gideon, and he says, the Lord is with you, a mighty man of valor. This is chapter 6, sorry. And Gideon said to him in verse 13, please, sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And some commenters suggest that this verse, verse 13 in chapter 6, is one of the central ideas in the whole book. Gideon said to him, please, sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian. And the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do not I send you? And he said to him, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And some commenters suggest that there are details later on in the narrative that suggest that's not true, that he's kind of embellishing his weakness. And the Lord said to him, but I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man. And he said to him, if now I have found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that is you who speak with me. And the text goes on. But what you want to hear here is there's an echo of Moses, kind of cowardly, wanting to avoid acceptance of the burden of responsibility of leading God's people. And whereas Moses is celebrated for how he's used, Gideon does not end with his people better off than he found them. He does deliver his people from the Midianites, but if we turn to chapter 8, verse 22, then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you, which is not true. The Lord will rule over you. And Gideon said to them, let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings of his spoil. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. And Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah, and all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. And the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. And so, where Moses essentially leaves his people in good hands, in Joshua's hands, and they have victory in Canaan, Gideon leaves his people in idolatry. And he leaves them with this idol that they have to deal with. And it's interesting because he says, my son will not rule over you, I will not be king over you. If you read in chapter 9, one of his sons does become king. And the name is fascinating because the name of the son is Abimelech, which means my father is king. So we question Gideon's sincerity when he says, no, I won't be your king, but I'm going to name my son my father is king. And he's going to end up king over this area. It's interesting. But Abimelech is a wicked, wicked, wicked man. And he's kind of an anti-deliverer. He's a tyrant. And what's interesting is a certain detail comes back up again. Abimelech dies in a siege where a woman throws a millstone from a high window and crushes his head. That should sound familiar. Because we're coming back to Jael and how she destroyed Sisera. Then we come to Jephthah. And Jephthah is a tragic account of the defeat of the king of Moab and the taking of the fjords, this time to kill the Ephraimites. All this should sound familiar because this is very similar to Ehud. It's just the flip side of the coin. Where Ehud's a comedic account because, if you don't remember the story, it's comedic because it really emphasizes kind of some silliness with Eglon. Eglon's a really fat king. And Ehud's kind of sneaky and tricky with him, and there's a lot of wordplay in the text. I remember someone saying Eglon means little calf in Hebrew, and Eglon, of course, it goes out of its way to describe how fat he is. And so there's some kind of amusing wordplay there. And even when Ehud says, I have a message from you from the Lord, some suggest it could be, I have a thing for you from the Lord, in which the thing is his sword in his gut. And so there's some wordplay going on. It can be an amusing read, whereas Jephthah is not at all. It's very tragic. He defeats the king of Moab. He takes the fjords of the Jordan, this time to kill the Ephraimites instead of fighting with the Ephraimites, as Ehud did. And why Jephthah's story is tragic, if you don't remember, is because he makes a vow in chapter 11 that if the Lord gives me victory, the first thing that walks through the door of my house, I will give to the Lord. And you might think, well, what did he expect to walk through his door? But in ancient times, it seems that the boundaries between your living quarters and your animal's living quarters was much more blurry, so he might have actually expected an animal to walk out of his front door that he would sacrifice to the Lord. But, of course, it's not an animal that comes through his door. It's his daughter. And there's a big debate over what it means to have kept his vow. Did he offer his daughter to the temple in the way that Hannah did Samuel, just in perpetual service to the Lord? Or did he actually offer her as a burnt offering and burn her alive for the Lord? And I would suggest, just given the degradation of the book, I think it's the second. It would fit with the flow of the book that this is just a nation that's continuing to degrade morally, making these ridiculous vows and thinking, well, I made a vow, I got to keep it. That comes up again later too. And so it seems like Jephthah actually does offer his daughter as a burnt offering, which we all know is something that God in his law never commanded. Human sacrifice was never acceptable. And then you come to Samson, who morally is the worst judge of all of them. And it's interesting because he's a Nazarite from birth, which is not normal. Nazarite vows are typically taken for a period of time. But he's a Nazarite from birth. He's supposed to be a special kind of deliverer, especially since there's divine revelation about his birth. You have the issue of barrenness again. But Samson turns out to be a monster, morally speaking. And to contrast with Othniel, his biggest weakness is pagan women. Where Othniel takes an Israelite wife and is faithful, Samson is chasing all kinds of pagan women. And so again, you're seeing how there's parallels. And this is what we call a chiasm, C-H-I-A-S-M. And that's where the book kind of comes like this as it progresses, to where the first and last points correspond, the second point and the second to last point correspond, the third point and the third to last point correspond, and the middle is kind of set apart and emphasized. And you see this in the Psalms all the time. But that's what you see with these judges. Othniel and Samson are to be contrasted. Ehud and Jephthah are to be contrasted. Deborah and Abimelech are to be compared and contrasted. And Gideon kind of is the central point that stands on its own. So those are the judges, the major judges. Another interesting detail is there are five minor judges, which brings our total of judges to 12. Well, I think there's six minor judges because I don't think Abimelech's counted as a judge. But the total number of judges in the book is 12, which is also important. Again, the author's selective, especially with those other judges, because sometimes they only get a line. Like Shamgar is one. There's only one sentence given about him in chapter 3 at the end. This is after Ehud. It says, after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad, and he also served Israel. That's all you get. So why include that? To get us to a total of 12 judges, because we want to get the point that the whole nation is falling into depravity. This is a systemic problem. So then we come to the double epilogue. in chapter 17. And like I said, this is, if you were to nominate certain sections of Scripture that are the darkest, this would be in the running for at least top five as far as passages. This section is littered with the phrase, "There was no king in Israel," which is a reminder. It's as if to say, hey, I know you're reading this, just keep in mind, we know this is bad. This is not being promoted. Nothing in this book is, in this section is good. There was no king in Israel. And twice, at the beginning, at the end, it adds on, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And so it's this big kind of apology, I guess, for including this section. Just, hey, guys, I know this is bad, but there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So what's going on here? 17 and 18 is the first epilogue, and 19 through 21 is the second epilogue. 17 and 18, you have an account of a man who sees a traveling Levite priest and hires him to be a priest for his idols that he has made. Then some men from the tribe of Dan come along, and they have not conquered the land that they were supposed to have conquered. They're looking for a place to settle down, and they decide, well, this place where this man hired is good. They end up stealing the man's idol, stealing the man's priest. They come to a city, they burn it down, and it's a city that wasn't given to them to conquer. And so this is the first of these epilogues, and it really emphasizes the wickedness of God's people. There's rampant idolatry. Priests, it's interesting, when the priest is hired by Micah, that's the man's name who hires him, and the Danites come along and say, come with us. I don't remember which verse it is, but it says here it is, verse 20 in chapter 18. It says, and the priest's heart was glad. Like, the commentary said the priest was happy for a promotion. Now he's not just the priest for one pagan man. Now he's the priest for a whole tribe. And so this is an upgrade. And it shows you how wicked the culture has become. And then it gets worse when you get to chapter 19. And you have the Levite priest and his concubine. And this is a different priest. It says in chapter 19, and that doesn't make it better. There's multiple priests that are really bad. In chapter 19, in those days, there was no king in Israel and a certain Levite. So it's saying a different guy. This isn't the same priest from the previous story. So a certain Levite is traveling around with a concubine, and they end up in Gibeah, which is a city in the tribe of Benjamin. And a story plays out that should really be reminding you of Sodom and Gomorrah. There are some lines that are almost taken word for word from Genesis 19. Now, this isn't because both authors happened to think of similar words to describe what happened here. The author wants you to think of Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, why would he want you to think of Sodom and Gomorrah? Because we know how wicked the men of Sodom were and the men of Gomorrah were. And they were wiped out as they should have been, obliterated. And now, a thing like this is happening among God's people. And again, it's emphasizing this is how far Israel has fallen. Now, such a horrible, wicked thing as has happened in Sodom and Gomorrah is now happening among God's people. And this time there are no angels to save the women who are offered. This time there is no protection for those women. And the priest uses the body of the dead woman to send to the tribes to encourage them to come to Gibeah and seek justice. And then there's this whole messed up account of a civil war between the rest of Israel and Benjamin. Benjamin does okay for a while, but eventually loses and loses big time to where There might not be a tribe of Benjamin anymore after this. And so they come up with all kinds of convoluted and wicked solutions to try and keep the tribe of Benjamin from going extinct, including at the end, basically telling the tribe of Benjamin, if you go out and grab these women who are dancing and take them back home, we won't come after you. So they're advocating for the tribe of Benjamin to steal women if they can find them just out and available. And as if, just to remind us, the very last verse of the book, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's the book. The primary themes of the book, we have leadership and rest as one of the main primary themes. The book begins by describing how the people were faithful when Joshua led them. But when everyone dies that knew Joshua, the nation begins the descent into idolatry and rampant wickedness. Each judge is progressively more conflicted or more wicked than the previous judge. And the big message here is Israel needs a covenant-keeping deliverer. Israel is needing some kind of leader that can actually bring righteousness and rest to the people of God. And I think it's after Gideon. I think Gideon is the last judge. Let's see. This would be chapter 8 or 9. Yeah, chapter 8. Verse 28. So this is with Gideon. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. If I remember correctly, this is the last time this kind of note is made, that the land had rest for so many years. The previous judges, it says, and the land had rest for this many years, and the land had rest for that many years. After Gideon, we lose that note, which is, again, trying to remind us, again, there's seven major narratives, and you would expect as you come to the last one, okay, now we're going to get rest. And Samson does not provide rest. And in fact, after that, you have the epilogues, which are horrible. The second major theme is idolatry and apostasy. Idolatry is the central problem of the book. It begins with the Israelites falling away to worship other gods. And we see it with Gideon, who makes an idol with the spoils of his victory. We see it with Samson, being led away by pagan women. And I don't know if I'm going to find it. Okay, chapter 10, verse 6 to the end of the chapter. This is kind of a status update about halfway through the book, and it describes how they're further sliding into idolatry and gives the names of more gods. It's as if they're adding more gods to their repertoire of gods that they worship. But there is a strange bit of encouragement at the end of the book. In chapter 20, verse 2, this is at the beginning of the war, the civil war, where Israel unites to seek justice on Benjamin. And in verse 2, it says, and the chiefs of all the people, of all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God. And we could stop there and say, it's still a good thing that the author even calls these people the people of God at this point. That God is not done with his people after all of this mess. And that's an encouragement for us. That no matter where we find ourselves, God is a God of sinners, of broken people. When we think of Judges in the larger story of the Bible, like we've already mentioned, there's echoes of the story so far all through Judges. You have Jael and the woman who kills Abimelech, both being an echo of Genesis 3:15. They crush the enemy of God's people's head. Barak and Gideon echo Moses in their eagerness to avoid responsibility for leading God's people. Jotham is one of Abimelech's brothers, and he has what should sound like a familiar account, because Abimelech wants to slaughter the 70 sons of Gideon. Yes, Gideon had 70 sons. And Abimelech's looking, okay, if the 70 sons have basically have some power in this new setup, well, if I wipe them all out, then I get all the power. And so Gideon looks to destroy all the sons of Gideon, Abimelech looks to destroy all the sons of Gideon, and Jotham is the one who escapes the slaughter and returns to challenge Abimelech. This is a story we've heard with Moses, with him escaping the slaughter of all the Hebrew boys. This is what we see later on with Jesus escaping the slaughter of all the Israelite boys in Bethlehem. In chapter 18, the Danites, this is so interesting. The Danites use some of the exact same language that we find in Numbers when they come to the promised land. They send spies into the land to see if it's good. The spies come back and report, and they say, okay, the land's good, let's go in. The Danites are showing more zeal in taking the land that is not given to them than the people of Israel did in Numbers. Again, it's a darker side of the coin. In 19, we've already talked about the parallels to Sodom and Gomorrah. So, Judges is not written in a vacuum. It's obviously drawing heavily from the Torah. And we can see how it points forward. Well, the text necessarily points us forward. We have Abimelech, who's a wicked king. We have all these verses. You have 17:6, 18:1, 19:1, and 21:25, all saying there was no king in Israel in those days. And so the natural way we are drawn to think is, well, we need a king then. We need a king so this doesn't happen. And the Old Testament, especially when you read Ruth, it's pulling us to David. That's kind of where the draw is. But of course, when we come to David, he is not able to give the rest either. And so we come to think of Christ as the king that we all truly need, the king that does provide rest. To ask the only question I've asked so far, because I didn't know what other questions ask, where do you see Christ in Judges? Has there been anything that you've heard or seen in your reading that makes us think of Christ in Judges? And it's going to be difficult because any figure you point at may just as good at telling you what Christ is not like than telling you what Christ is like. But there are a couple. There are a couple that I found were interesting. Where do you see Christ in Judges?
Yes, but they're asking us to answer.
Yes. Yes.
Can very well see that line put out there as for who Jesus is going to be. And so we see Jesus in that regard.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's really hard not to see it in Samson, even though Samson.
Yes. Yes. He gives his life to wipe out God's enemies.
Right. And he's prophesied, the birth is prophesied.
Yes. So you have both.
And he's told that he's going to have a certain name, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And I do think Jotham is interesting for as little bit of text as we get about him, that he's the one who escapes the slaughter of all of his brothers and comes back to challenge the wicked king.
For a risk of sounding very trivial, he's just, Jesus is the cycle breaker.
Yeah. Yes.
That breaks that and is perfect
Yeah.
And I don't think that we have any accounts of the people of God ever rising up to kill a judge. And they were all super evil. But Jesus was perfect. They killed
him. Yeah, that's true. That's true. When we were talking about leadership and rest earlier, I made the comment that Israel needs a covenant-keeping deliverer. And of course, Jesus is the only one who can really fulfill that role, being a covenant-keeping deliverer, keeping all the covenants. Are there any questions about anything we've talked about this morning or comments? Yes.
And in the new heavens and the new earth, there will be a king over the new Israel, and nobody will do what is right in their own eyes.
Yes.
You see like the total opposite picture with Christ in the end of his reign.
Yes. And there will be eternal rest.
Yeah.
That's not going to be a period of rest and a period of captivity. There's going to be an eternal rest.
So
yes.
As we shudder at all the horridness of it all,
yes.
That's the iniquity that Christ was bearing.
Yes. Cool.
Also related to what both of you were saying, when you were talking about Jotham and how Abimelech went ahead and wanted to kill all his brothers technically.
Yeah.
Well, we see a reconciliation in that regard, and we also see judgment as described in Revelation being showcased there, because when we talk about Christ's coming and the final coming, we talk about the tears being wiped away and all sorts of things there. Even though it's not a very perfect representation, we sort of see that in its own way happening,
mm-hmm.
where Abimelech, in spite of conquering all these people and things like that, there is still someone that stands up against him.
Yes.
And I feel like we see a repeated pattern of that in different books where, like, say, kings and things like that, different leaders rose up and then they got put down and things like that. Like Matt said, Christ is always the cycle breaker.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we're about out of time, so we better pray.